Coming up on Tech Nation, ever think about looking at the planet as simply a system of roads? From multi-lane highways to small country lanes to miles of dirt roads everywhere, every road has an impact. I speak with science journalist Ben Goldfarb about his book, Crossings: A Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Then, when is a medical technology company more than a medical technology company? We'll hear all about it when I speak with Dave Pacitti, the president of Siemens Healthineers. They're out to solve problems bigger than the products they're known for. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take 5 with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2017, I spoke with Dr. Rita Colwell, the first woman to head the National Science Foundation, the recipient of the National Medal of Science, a distinguished university professor at both the University of Maryland and Johns Hopkins University, and the founder and chair of the bioinformatics company Cosmos ID. With all her many accomplishments, scientist, professor, inventor, and even entrepreneur, I asked her, you've had many signature positions in your career, but did you know when you accepted the position of director of the National Science Foundation, this would be the one that everyone would remember you by?
That's a wonderful aspect of it. Everybody recognizes and respects the National Science Foundation. And so I think you get a kind of an aura and a rapport with everybody, including both sides of the aisle in Congress, which I really was very impressed with. I felt very good about that.
Now, when you are president of NSF, do you have to deal with Congress to get funding, or is it kind of given?
No, you really do have to deal with Congress. You spend a lot of time, or at least I spent a lot of time on the Hill, really explaining what we're doing, letting them know what our plans were, because it was really important for them to understand that everything was above board, straight, honest. This is what we need to do. This is why it's good for the country. And they understood. And I think they may have had their differences in their political views, but fundamentally, they do want what's best for the country. And if you're able to explain to them that what you're doing in science, engineering, technology, mathematics is very important for the country, and they can understand it, then they're supportive.
Now, during President Obama's State of the Union speech in January 2016, almost a year ago now, he announced the National Cancer Moonshot. And in the past year, over 70 companies have made commitments to support that effort. Remind us what the National Cancer Moonshot is and what the company you founded, Cosmos ID, has contributed.
We're very excited about this opportunity because it is sort of the next important qualitative leap to finding cures to cancer. And actually, I should say cancer is plural because it's really not one entity. It's a mixture of them. And understanding the genetics, the human genetics, but also in the case of the company that I have founded, the role that microorganisms play, bacteria, viruses, fungus, parasites, play in either triggering cancer or, when it occurs, exacerbating it, making it worse. So it's an exciting time to take all of these tools of science and engineering to make that next big step, the next jump in being able to understand cancer, how to treat it. And what's very interesting is that the immunology side of it is turning out to be quite an important factor. Now, the company I founded uses nucleic acid, DNA, and the RNA, other types of nucleic acid, to determine exactly what's present. So we can extract the DNA, let's say from a tumor or from the tissue surrounding the tumor, extract the DNA, and then with the algorithms, with a computer algorithm that we've developed, we can, within minutes, determine exactly the bacteria down to species, strain, and substrain, the viruses, the fungus, and the parasites, everything at once, within minutes. And this is really exciting because it means we can diagnose so rapidly and be able to treat appropriately and quickly. So we're really kind of revisiting some of the early studies in a much more refined and elegant molecular way of determining the information.
This 2017 TechNation interview features Dr. Rita Colwell, the 11th director and first woman to lead the National Science Foundation. Today, her interests are focused on global infectious diseases, water, and health. She is currently developing an international network to address emerging infectious diseases and water issues. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, we talk about roads and roads and even more roads, some 40 million miles of roads all around the world. From the one that runs in front of your house to the highway you take to the airport, from interconnected highway systems in nearly every country to small country roads to even the illegal logging roads throughout the Amazon. The Amazon? How many can that possibly be? Would you believe 100,000 miles worth? Well, individually and collectively, they all have an impact. I speak with science journalist Ben Goldfarb about crossings, how road ecology is shaping the future of our planet. Then a multifaceted medical technology company aims to solve even larger problems. I'll speak with Dave Pacitti, president of Siemens Healthineers.
Tech Nation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Ben Goldfarb. Well, Ben, welcome to Tech Nation.
Thank you so much for having me, Moira. I appreciate it.
Now, where there is dirt, there is the option for a road, and we have roads all over the planet. Give us the numbers here.
Right. So we've got about 40 million miles of road around the world, about 4 million miles here in the United States. And we're building more all the time. We're entering what's known as the infrastructure tsunami, this period of new construction that's going to add around 15 million miles of paved road to our planet by the middle of this coming century, and certainly tens of millions of miles more of unpaved roads. We've got a lot of roads out there, and certainly a lot more coming.
How much of the landmass does this take up?
Well, it's interesting to think about, right? Because the roads themselves don't take up a whole lot of land mass. You know, perhaps 1% of the United States is pavement, which, you know, is a big area, but, you know, not a huge proportion. But, you know, the road effect zone, right, which is sort of the area that's influenced by the road due to noise pollution and habitat fragmentation and, you know, and salt runoff and all the different things, the different ecological issues that that roads cause, that road effect zone is up to 20% of the country. So even though these roads are these little linear strips of asphalt, you know, just 100 feet wide from shoulder to shoulder, they're having these enormous ecological impacts to a huge swath of our country and this planet.
Now, you write about a road that wends its way through Glacier National Park, so you know there's not a lot of buildings and infrastructure there around it. And you said a vehicle inching its way along casts a sonic shadow nearly 3 miles wide. Sounds like they've measured this.
Right. So that's going to the Sun Road, which is, you know, sort of the most famous road, one of the most famous roads in our whole national park system, you know, and like so many roads in national parks, you know, it's kind of built to display the most beautiful views of the scenery, which means that it kind of inches up this cliff face up, you know, into the mountains. And that just means that it's broadcasting traffic noise, at a truly huge scale. And, you know, that noise pollution, which we're so awash in, we don't really think about it, you know. And yet it's this enormous form of habitat loss for all kinds of critters. You know, if you're a songbird who has to sing to attract a mate and your mates can't hear you over the, you know, the grumble of engines and tires, you know, you can't live in that place, right? So that acoustic envelope that you were talking about really has an enormous impact on nature.
So What else happens in the road effects zone besides noise here?
Yeah, you know, that's certainly a big one. I think another really big one is sort of this chemical transformation that goes on, right? There are all kinds of substances leaching from our vehicles, you know, cadmium and copper and zinc and microplastics. You know, we shed something like 6 million tons of tire particles into nature every year, which have enormous impacts on fish, especially. So there's this huge chemical transformation. You know, road salt is another gigantic force of change. You know, we add 20 million tons of road salt to our highways every year as a de-icing substance. And then all of that road salt runs off into rivers and lakes and turns them into kind of brackish estuaries. You know, something like half the lakes in the Midwest are turning saltier over time because of this road salt pollution issue. So we're just changing. I mean, roads are these huge forces of ecological change on the chemical and sensory level.
These are the kinds of roads that we're familiar with. You note that there are 100,000 miles of illegal logging routes through the Amazon. Can we even guess their impact?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really good point in the sense that, you know, the road itself has all of these physical discrete impacts, right? It's creating roadkill and it's leaching road salt and it's, you know, it's impacting noise pollution and so on. And yet that's only the tip of the iceberg in some ways, because then you've got all of the ecological transformation that those roads inflict upon nature. You know, they're sort of the roots of all evil, R-O-U-T-E-S, as I put it in the book. You know, because look, before you can illegally log the Amazon, you know, you need roads to get the machinery in and the product out, right? And, you know, roads precede mining and oil and gas drilling and, you know, suburbanization and, I mean, every other sort of ecological problem that you can conceive of is in some way facilitated by roads. So, you know, this subject of road ecology that I'm writing about in this book is in some ways the whole story of landscape transformation around the world.
Well, in the case of the Amazon, first of all, are those roads the same kind of roads we have where they quickly lay down a lot of asphalt and then they go? And secondly, whether it's that kind of road or some other kind of road, can you unbuild a road?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So you know, the vast majority of those Amazonian roads are dirt roads, and you know, and certainly that's true around the world. You know, in many countries, 90% of the infrastructure is dirt. You know, so here in the U.S., we also have huge volumes of dirt road. You know, the largest road manager in the country and even in the world is actually the U.S. Forest Service, the federal agency that manages around 190 million acres of American public land. And the Forest Service has something like 400,000 miles of road in its holdings, you know, and a lot of those were old roads built for timber harvest and firefighting and recreation and other purposes, you know, in the early to mid 20th century. And, you know, they're still in the landscape. And the vast majority of those roads are dirt roads. And, you know, they don't get a lot of traffic. So they don't have some of the problems that other big paved highways have. But, you know, they're also bleeding sediment into the environment constantly, which, you know, runs downhill and triggers landslides and, you know, smothers important fish streams and so on. So those dirt roads have huge impacts. You know, as to your question about unbuilding a road, that's a really wonderful question, because we're doing that in some cases around this country. You know, the Forest Service and various, you know, nonprofits and partners are taking some of those old dirt roads that have kind of outlived their historic utility, and they're actually obliterating them, deconstructing them, you know, taking heavy machinery and tearing out all of these, you know, these historic harmful roads that have been on the landscape for many decades. So look, we're not going to do that to, you know, I-90 probably, but, you know, in the case of it, at least some of these, you know, these smaller unpaved roads, you know, there's an incredible opportunity to kind of deconstruct our infrastructure for the sake of nature.
And they have to take out the dirt. I mean, we all know that our cars leach oil and all kinds of things, and that goes directly into the dirt. It's absorbed. You can't just leave it there. Nothing will grow.
Yeah, you know, they've had a lot of success with replanting some of those roads. You know, they take in heavy machinery, you know, excavators and backhoes, and they just kind of claw up the surface, because, you know, the challenge with a lot of those old dirt roads is that they're super compacted, right? You've got 30 years of logging trucks, you know, rolling up and down these roads, and all of that weight is just, you know, hardening that layer. So if you just walk away from it, you're right that nothing's really going to grow there, because the soil is just so hard and compact that it's impossible for plants to really take root. So what they do is they take that heavy machinery and they just claw up that roadbed, and that creates all of kind of loosens the soil and creates all of those little pockets where, you know, seeds can take hold and sprout. So, you know, you're right that it's not enough to just walk away from a road and leave it. You know, you really have to unbuild what we built, decades ago.
I was wondering about, now more local to a simple blacktop road, is the edge of the road. And the British actually have a term for the ecology at the edge of roads. They call it the soft estate. Tell us about the ecology at the edge of a road.
Yeah, you know, those roadsides are so interesting, because they're, you know, in some cases, these little slivers of habitat. You know, we've been talking about roads as sort of these forces of habitat loss and destruction for lots of species, but they're also forces of habitat creation in some places. You know, and you mentioned, the British calling the roadside the soft estate. You know, in a really cultivated landscape like the UK or like the American Midwest, you know, so much of the landscape is agriculture and sort of monoculture. And, you know, some of the last strips of diverse prairie, with lots of wildflowers and shrubs and other vegetation are those roadsides. So, you know, here in the U.S., those roadsides along big interstates like I-35, even in the Midwest, have become important sources of habitat for monarch butterflies and other species that have been, you know, squeezed out of so much of the country by industrial agriculture. But, you know, look, obviously, the road is still a really dangerous place, you know, and for all of the reasons we've been talking about, the cars themselves and the chemical changes and the noise pollution and so on. So, you know, yes, animals can in some cases find sustenance in this soft estate, this roadside habitat, but, you know, that's also a dangerous place for them to be. And, you know, a lot of them can become kind of collateral damage. There's a real risk of the road becoming what scientists call it an ecological trap, you know, this system that lures animals in by promising them, you know, milkweed and other food plants and then kills them.
Plan B, not a soft estate. Plan B, and it didn't work out real well.
Exactly. Right. Nothing wants to live along the road. You know, that's kind of where we've just exiled some of these species.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is award-winning science journalist Ben Goldfarb. He's here today with Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Some animals have evolved, and once evolved, we might say thrive, with roads and, we'll say, road-associated technologies. I'm thinking here of the cliff swallow.
Yeah, the cliff swallow is really an amazing story and one of my favorite stories in the book. So cliff swallows are these birds that build these little mud nests, and often they build them on the underside of highway bridges and overpasses. And we've all probably driven under them and, you know, maybe noticed them. But because cliff swallows live over highways, in many cases, they're vulnerable to roadkill. And what a scientist named Charles Brown discovered, in the course of many decades of studying cliff swallows, is that, yes, they do get hit by cars and trucks, but they've become less susceptible to roadkill over time. You know, he basically counted cliff swallow roadkill in Nebraska over the course of several decades, and basically found that fewer and fewer cliff swallows were getting hit by cars. And he kind of wondered, okay, why is that?
Did they get smart?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so when he actually studied these cliff swallows and looked closely at their little bodies, you know, what he found was that their wings were becoming shorter. And the reason for that is that if you're a bird and you have a long wing, that's good for flying long straight distances. But having a short wing is good for maneuverability, for making all of those little tight turns that you would use to get out of the way of an 18-wheeler. So the long wing cliff swallows were getting hit by cars, and the short wing cliff swallows were surviving. And so you had, you know, natural selection leading to this shorter winged population. I just love that story because, you know, we think about evolution as being this process that happens over, you know, thousands or millions of years. And yet, you know, cars are such a powerful selective pressure that they're driving evolution in just a few decades.
We often think of roads saying, gee, we, you know, herds and animals can't cross them. But some animals actually like them because they carry them further. And that's like the wolf.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting idea that, you know, that roads are travel corridors, you know, for humans, obviously, but, you know, also for other species as well. And, you know, there's just a great study that was done around Voyageurs National Park in northern Minnesota, where researchers basically found that, you know, that wolves were using all of these old logging roads and ATV trails and, you know, human linear features through the landscape. They were using them as travel corridors, you know, and patrolling their territories on these roads, and actually were more likely to kill deer closer to the, you know, the roads that we've provided them. So, you know, look, obviously a densely trafficked road, as you say, is a huge barrier to animal movement and mobility, and, you know, and most wildlife won't cross a heavily trafficked road. But, you know, some of these dirt roads can become become travel corridors for humans and non-humans alike.
And I have to say, you know, in San Francisco we do things differently, and just yesterday a coyote, and yes, we have coyotes in San Francisco, a coyote went up an on-ramp onto the freeway.
Oh, wow.
Which runs on the south side of the city, goes onto the Bay Bridge. This is like the major freeway through San Francisco. And the coyote stopped traffic for an hour and then left, and they can't find him.
Oh, really? Good. Well, I hope that coyote is out there flourishing. And I mean, look, they're, you know, those are such smart animals, obviously. And, you know, there are all kinds of great stories about coyotes and roads. But, you know, my favorite is that in Chicago, which, you know, like San Francisco, has this very large and famous urban coyote population. You know, their coyotes actually use the crosswalks at the red lights. And they've been documented looking both ways before crossing the street. So, you know, those are some pretty smart canines.
Now, did you hear the wolves give that big shout out when they heard about that? They were listening to the show, heard about that coyote. I kind of heard that in the background there. I kind of heard that.
You heard the howl.
I heard the howl. There you go. Now, to our list of new jobs, we can now add the job road ecologists. Okay, I'm game. What do they do?
Yeah, so this book is really about, you know, road ecology, which is this big field of science that looks at all of the different ways that roads shape nature, you know, all of the different ways we've been talking about, from this barrier effect that roads create for animal movement, to roadkill, to, you know, road salt runoff, to noise pollution, and so on. And so road ecology is really the field of science that looks at all of those different connections and, you know, most important, what we do about them. How do we solve some of the problems that roads create? So, you know, road ecologists they're the people who practice that field. And, you know, the term road ecology is really only a few decades old. So it's a pretty new field. And, you know, I think that maybe one of the things that held it back a little bit is that, look, if you're somebody who loves nature and wildlife and, you know, wants to be a wildlife biologist and study the natural world, you know, you want to go off to, you know, the Alaskan wilderness or down the Grand Canyon or something, right? You don't want to, you know, sit by the side of I-80 and count trucks as they go by and, you know, watch poor deer and antelope get pulverized, right? So it's, you know, the roadside is not necessarily...
That would be a bad job.
That would be a bad job. Yeah. And yet, you know, road ecologists have kind of taken that job upon themselves. And it's, I mean, it's just kind of fascinating to watch this field, you know, really, really explode in a lot of ways. I mean, I feel like I started writing about roads and nature about 10 years ago. And in that relatively short time, you know, I just feel like I meet so many more people who self-identify as road ecologists. And this field has really become, you know, incredibly vital. And, you know, the conferences are bigger every single year. So it's kind of blowing up right now. It's exciting.
Well, the scientific study of the impact of roads, that's relatively new itself.
Yeah, it is. Although, you know, in some ways, it does really go back to the advent of the car, you know, which is fascinating. You know, you go back and read old scientific journals from the 1920s, and, you know, there are all of these wildlife biologists driving around the countryside in Illinois and Iowa, and they're seeing this new phenomenon, roadkill. And, you know, the term roadkill didn't exist at that time. It wasn't invented until the 1940s. But, you know, in the 1920s, you know, cars are increasingly abundant on the American landscape, and they're killing lots of people all of a sudden, and people are sort of freaking out about the toll that cars are taking on American society and human lives. And, you know, there are all these biologists saying, yeah, and also what about wild animals? And they're out there counting dead ground squirrels and garter snakes and woodpeckers and other critters, saying, you know, hey, this is a really an alarming new threat to wild animal populations. So this field of study really goes back 100 years, even if, you know, the term road ecology is a pretty novel one. More recently, the term road ecology was really coined in English in the mid-1990s by Richard Foreman, who's a kind of a famous, renowned landscape ecologist at Harvard. And the story he told me that I thought was really profound was that one day he was in his office with his students, and they had this big picture of a forest that they were looking at and talking about, and he was sort of expounding on all of the different features in the picture. You know, here's where the wild animals move, and here's, you know, why humans put their houses where they did, and here's where the water goes across the landscape. And, you know, right down the middle of the picture through the forest was a road. And, you know, he kind of stopped and said, wait a second, you know, we know a lot about everything else that's happening in this picture, but we don't really know much about the road itself and how it's impacting ecosystems and nature, you know. And I think that kind of gets to the issue with roads, right? They're so ubiquitous. They're such a constant force in our daily lives. Most of us use them every single day. And as a result, I think we take them for granted or don't really notice them. We don't think about them very much because we're just using them constantly. And they're kind of the backdrop to our lives. And yet they're having these enormous impacts and, you know, and really distinctive, discrete impacts on nature.
And you can't really see them unless you're in an airplane and you have a satellite picture, you have a drone. It's like you kind of see them a few hundred feet at a time. That's your consciousness of where it is. So you can't really get a big picture unless you're really up high.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And, you know, I remember talking to this wildlife biologist recently in New Mexico, and, you know, he was kind of concerned about the impacts that all of these new subdivisions in the Albuquerque suburbs were going to have on elk and deer and antelope and all these other creatures. And he showed me these satellite images of the roads that had been built to support these subdivisions, right? Before you can build a whole new development, obviously you need the roads to put the houses on. And it was just so eerie in some ways, you know, seeing this endless grid of asphalt just spreading out into the desert. There was something really, really surreal and strange about it. When you strip away the houses and isolate the roads, you just realize, especially from above, as you say, you know, how inescapable these forces are.
I've been speaking with Ben Goldfarb about crossings, how road ecology is shaping the future of our planet. We'll talk more after a break. Both Whole Tech Nation programs and biotech-only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, we'll hear from Dave Pacitti, the president of Siemens Healthineers. The sophisticated medical equipment of today does us no good if we don't have qualified people to run them or people can't get access to them. Stay with us. You are listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with science journalist Ben Goldfarb. He's here today with Crossings, how road ecology is shaping the future of our planet. Now, engineers only build technology in response to the problem or problems they believe they are solving. Mm. Now, we've talked about some of the issues, you know, the noise and this. What are sort of the new parameters for building roads, especially since we have 25 million miles of them coming up?
Yeah, you know, I think that we're starting to think much more about the impacts that roads have on nature, and we're trying to build that into our infrastructure in a lot of cases. I mean, look, here in the U.S., you know, most of our major roads are already built. You know, we're actually not building new highways, really. I mean, once in a while, you know, we put in a new one, but, you know, most of the new roads we're building are sort of these smaller residential roads. And, you know, when it comes to our major highways, we're retrofitting rather than constructing from scratch. But, you know, in a lot of the developing world where this infrastructure tsunami we've been talking about is really blowing up, you know, they are building their infrastructure from scratch. And, you know, there are some great examples of places that are thinking about wildlife from the get-go. You know, there's a really wonderful story that I tell briefly in the book about this new highway in India that was built through a tiger sanctuary. Obviously, you wouldn't want that. That's not ideal. But, you know, they actually elevated the entire highway for many miles on these giant concrete pillars so that animals could, you know, walk back and forth underneath the highway, which, you know, is a pretty radical, progressive thing to do. I mean, obviously, here in the U.S., we've built lots of wildlife crossings, overpasses and underpasses and tunnels that animals can use to navigate our highways. And we're getting better at that, and we're building more of those and learning a lot, which is great. But at the same time, you know, those are still sort of these smaller, isolated retrofits on existing infrastructure, whereas countries like India and Myanmar and Brazil and Kenya that are building out their roadways really now can ideally learn from our environmental mistakes here in North America and do it right, or at least less wrong the first time.
Now, of course, nobody's surprised at, as you say, bridges for bears and tunnels for turtles. But I really stopped when I read rope webs for howler monkeys to swing over highways. Where is this?
Yeah, you know, there are lots of those in, you know, especially in South America and in Brazil, which, you know, there's one chapter of the book that's about road ecology in Brazil. And I went down there, and, you know, everywhere you go in parks, especially, you know, you see these really cool, they kind of look like, you know, like ropes courses that you do at an adventure camp, you know, that are suspended over the roadway and, you know, allow all kinds of primates to go back and forth. All of these monkeys that, you know, live up in the canopy, obviously, and, you know, the road fragments their habitat and they can't cross the roads. They're stuck in these little isolated patches of forest. But, you know, because they don't really like to descend to the ground, so they wouldn't be able to, you know, find an underpass, so that, you know, you really have to connect the forest via the canopy. And so, you know, these lots of road ecologists in Brazil have added these really cool canopy bridges that, you know, that the monkeys use very readily. And, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from that for us here in the U.S., right? We don't have monkeys, obviously, but, you know, we've got lots of tree-dwelling animals. You know, we've got flying squirrels and martens and porcupines and all kinds of, you know, arboreal critters that would use these things if we built them. So, you know, there's a lot that we can learn here in North America, I think, from some of the cool innovations that are happening in other countries.
Well, there's no doubt that you are telling stories from everywhere, and I feel like you traveled everywhere. Tell us, where did you go, as you describe in the book, and how long did it take you?
Oh boy. Yeah, you know, I mean, I went to a lot of cool places. You know, there's a chapter in Brazil. There's a chapter in Tasmania, in Australia, that I really enjoyed working on, basically about animal rehabilitation in Australia, where there are lots of animal rehabbers who, you know, go around picking up road orphaned animals and raising them to adulthood. You know, Australia has a really just an amazing culture of animal rehab that, you know, we could also learn a lot from, I think. I went to Costa Rica as well, where there's some really interesting road research going on, mostly involving frogs and snakes and other sort of cold-blooded animals that we don't often think about because they're sort of small and inconspicuous and we don't notice them when we run them over. And yet, those amphibians and reptiles, in many cases are some of the worst victims of cars. So I went to Costa Rica for that and lots of travel in the US as well. There's just so many interesting things happening in the U.S. from a road ecology perspective. So I had the chance to go to, places like Western Washington, where they're rebuilding roads to allow salmon to cross under the roads, and places like Idaho and Montana, where they're demolishing some of those old dirt Forest Service roads we were talking about, as well as Syracuse, New York, where they're taking out this urban freeway I-81. This kind of giant viaduct that was built very deliberately through a historic Black community in the 1960s, and now they're trying to sort of remedy that disaster. So yeah, this book took me to a lot of fascinating, diverse, disparate places.
Well, it sure did, and we are really glad you're here. So thank you so much for joining me. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you so much, Maria. I appreciate the great questions.
My guest today is Ben Goldfarb. The book is Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. When is a medical technology company more than a medical technology company? When it sets out to solve problems greater than simply supplying just the best technology. Dave Pacitti is the president of Siemens Healthineers. Well, Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to see you.
It seems like none of us can go into any medical setting without seeing a great variety of equipment with Siemens associated labels. Still, I have to ask you about something else. I know in just preparing for this interview, I saw that in your college years, you were a big football player and you went on to sign with the Miami Dolphins. Now, while I talk to a lot of company presidents, I don't get a lot of former NFL players. And I want to ask you, you got drafted, you were signed, you show up. When did it really hit you? I'm a Miami Dolphin.
I think it hit me when I had to run lots of wind sprints in that hot Miami heat. It really hit me well then. And so I wasn't drafted. I was a free agent. I was signed. Way back in 1990, as you mentioned, I played football in college at Villanova University, which my father went to Villanova as well, and many family members went there. So the football thing was great. I signed a free agent contract in 1990. It was a great part of my life, and as you can imagine, I grew up from an Italian family, and nobody played that football. They played a different kind of football.
Soccer.
Yeah, yes.
What we call soccer, they call football.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And it took a lot of years to sort of separate myself from football and make people believe I could do the job I'm doing today. But I will say, I don't think I would be as effective as I am if from my football background. I learned so much, especially about teamwork and collaboration. And the desire to win and really desire to get better every day, right? That's what you learn from playing such a tough team sport. And football was really hard, but I'll tell you what we're going to talk about today is even harder, right? A lot has to do with healthcare in the United States and its complex problems that we're working on. So football gave me a good foundation, but I'm really excited about what I'm doing today and really hopefully making a big impact our team is.
Well, it's tough training, unavailable to me, thank goodness. But good for you and good for Siemens Healthineers. Now, yeah. As I said earlier, you'd be hard-pressed to go into a medical setting and not see a Siemens-associated label on equipment everywhere. Remind us, what is Siemens, and then what is Siemens Healthineers in particular?
Yeah, so Siemens has been a large industrial conglomerate. Siemens AG, that's been around for well over 100 years, based in Germany. Siemens Siemens had a medical division. It was just called Siemens Medical, that was spun out into the market in 2017. And we got a new name, Siemens Healthineers. And then we became our own company. Siemens AG is a majority shareholder of Siemens Healthineers, but we, you know, are an independent company now, and you know, have our own stock symbol and on the exchange. And that all happened back in 2017. But we still obviously collaborate well with our Siemens AG colleagues.
So what's the difference, though? I mean, why Healthineers? What does that mean?
So Healthineers is really, we're focused on healthcare. The other parts of Siemens are industrial companies, like making trains and airplane engines, and smart infrastructure, and a lot to do in the end. There's a Siemens Energy business that has now spun off as well. So think of it as a very large industrial company. Siemens Healthineers is 100% focused in healthcare, and we make medical products. We had started out primarily as a diagnostic company, so imaging like MRIs and CAT scans. We have laboratory tests, and we make laboratory equipment. But then during COVID, we bought Varian, which is now a part of Siemens Healthineers.
A very old company, by the way. Very old.
Yeah, also. So there's a lot of old companies around, right? Varian has a great legacy, but it's a radiation oncology company. So we're now actually delivering therapy, not just doing diagnostic work. And then, as you know, in a very difficult field, radiation oncology is treating cancer patients. So, and we're really excited to have Varian as part of the team for the last couple of years, and it's been a great synergies between the two companies.
Now, all of that I could find online. That's easy. But what I found fascinating is that you are going beyond, well, here's our diagnostics, here's our treatment equipment, here's all of this. You're going beyond that into health, if you will, in terms of the reach of what you're doing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, you know, and I stated this earlier, healthcare, no matter where you are in the world, is complicated, right? Every country's got a different system, and it has its flaws, and they have their benefits, right? So we know whether in Latin America or South America or in the U.S., there's a lot of complexities in healthcare. And we've started an enterprise business that we call Value Partnerships. It's really focused on trying to solve the biggest challenges in healthcare. So we're thrilled when someone wants to buy our equipment, right? And that's all we used to do. But now we come into an institution and say, how about we try to help you solve some of your biggest challenges? And some of those challenges could be workforce related. They could be driving efficiencies in the hospital. It could be around addressing disparities in care. And we certainly don't say that we can do healthcare better than a hospital, but we think we can help in certain areas. And we've taken on that challenge, and we've started these value partnerships, and we're thrilled to have them. We only do a few a year, and we have 150 of these partnerships worldwide and 21 of these partnerships in the U.S. specifically. Why these are important, and if you're a patient in a healthcare institution, right? So if it's you, someone in your family, or it's me, one of my kids, right? There are problems in our healthcare system, and what we're trying to do is address those problems. Imagine you have to get a critical test done. You're a patient and you need an MRI done on your brain, right? But one of the challenges, because their workforce, they're short workers, that MRI can't happen for 4 months. That's a real scenario today in the U.S. healthcare system in some places. And what we're doing with healthcare institutions, that's just one example, we're helping them address their workforce needs so people don't have to wait as long to get a test. Also, if you're someone who is uncomfortable, getting care, right? Or you don't have access to care. Well, it gets harder if there's less workers, right? Because then the access is, you don't have as much access, right? So that's one of the problems we're working on in these partnerships that's very relatable to anyone. I know I call and I have to wait so long to see a doctor. It's hard, right? Or get a test done. You know, I have my youngest son is autistic. There's not a lot of pediatricians that are child early development pediatricians, right? So when my wife made the appointment, it took 7 months to go see that this. And that's a shortage, right? That's because there are shortages. That in that case, there's a shortage of pediatric physicians that specialize in children that have neuro problems. So there's one of the issues that I think is very relatable for people to understand that we're helping institutions address.
So you could have equipment standing there, but if you have no one operating it, you can't get into it. You just can't get into it.
You said it better than I did. That's exactly it, right? So there's a lot of ways to address that. One, you know, we believe that by utilizing technology, we've learned now that we have utilizing technology, we can operate more than one piece of equipment with less people, right? So using AI and automation, you could have one technician run multiple MRIs as an example, right? Which helps if you can't find four MRI techs, you have one tech that can run four MRIs as an example, right? So technology plays a role in this, right? Technology is super important. Just like with doctors, we have artificial intelligence now that helps radiologists look for things that maybe are not prescribed on the test. You know, if I'm a patient and I have pneumonia, okay, and the doctor writes a prescription, Dave, you need to go get a chest CT because I want to verify if you have pneumonia or something else is going on. We now have technology. When you get that CT for pneumonia, the CT tells the doctor this, doctor, yes, Dave has pneumonia. But oh, by the way, sort of with a red green light system, you should be looking at these other things and following up with Dave that has nothing to do with his pneumonia. Right?
That's exactly where technology comes in.
Exactly.
It's not paying attention because I analyze everything I know how to analyze. And there you are.
Yeah. And they're busy, right? So a lot of times a doctor, because they're so busy and they have to look at so many scans in this example, a day, they wouldn't have time to look for all those other things. That's why bringing it to their attention is super important. So Jen, just another example where technology plays a role in addressing workforce shortage. But it goes a step further. That's not the only way to do it. There's a little bit of we have to roll up our sleeves and also find new workers, right? Technology is not going to solve all the problems. So one example that we can share with you, the SSM in St. Louis, which is a large health system in the Midwest based in St. Louis, we're actually working with SSM, the health system, and the Urban League in St. Louis to identify candidates that might want to go to tech school to become a healthcare professional. And they're really looking in the underserved communities and the minority communities in St. Louis, where people might not even know about these jobs exist. And the Urban League will be sort of the host. And then between SSM and Siemens Healthineers, we'll work together in creating the curriculum. You know, it takes time, but some of these programs, you don't need a college degree, depending on what it is, right? And you could go through like a certificate program to get certified to be, whether it's a rad tech or something, or laboratory tech or a phlebotomist. So we got to do it more than one way, technology and the old grassroots effort of really trying to find the workers of the future.
I like that.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Stand on a street corner and say, hey, want a career? That's good.
Exactly. People are looking for that, you know. So it's exciting, the work that we're doing. And we don't do it by ourselves. We're doing it with our partners, right?
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you're also working with the University of Missouri, I mean, developing curriculum for biomedical engineering. I mean, what is that about?
Yes, correct. It's a great example. So at the University of Missouri, which I'm actually going there today, we work together collaboratively with the university there. They have a biomedical engineering program. What we worked with them on was creating a certificate program, some of it funded by the state of Missouri. So we got a grant, you know, the university did, and we created a clinical engineering program that actually takes these students and they get certified in how to fix our equipment. And they get a job, they come work for Siemens Healthineers, they can work for the University of Missouri, they can work for another health system, or they can work for another company. But it's a very creative idea that the teams came up with. First of all, there's more dollars out there at the state and federal level for workforce development, especially in healthcare, because everyone knows this is a problem, right? We have a shortage of workers, also in other fields, as you know, too, but in healthcare, it's super important. So we're also trying to tap into those funds with universities or and medical institutions so that we can access and create new training programs. And we're spending a lot of time in creating curriculum for those training programs. And our team has been involved in developing that curriculum. We were also involved in the helping with the grant writing process, as an example, too. So it's been a great example of two great organizations, University of Missouri and Siemens Healthineers, working together to create meaningful new jobs in the marketplace.
Now, it's one thing to work with the medical centers. It's one thing to go out, you know, develop all these workers and get education for them so that they can participate, not just with you, but anywhere in the field here. You're really working on that. But there's another program that you have that I thought was pretty fascinating, and it's this mobile mammography unit. This would be breast cancer screening, or what I call the truck. You're taking the truck. Tell us about this.
Yeah, no, it's a great one. And so, yes, we have a truck, a large RV almost, I would call it. You walk into it, and it looks like a very much like an aesthetic setting, and you're walking into a procedural room at a hospital, like if you were getting a mammography, you know, and it has our equipment in there. So we have some wonderful examples. We've done this all around the country. We've done it at Wake Med. We've done it at MUSC. We've done it at the University of Pennsylvania. We've done it at Missouri, and we're looking forward to do it more places. So the way it works is we bring the truck. It's a Siemens Healthineers truck. It has our equipment in it, and we go into a local town with one of our partners, and we set up shop. We actually set up shop with the truck, not at the hospital, because you're not really reaching people if you go to the hospital. That's one of the problems. Sometimes people are intimidated going to the hospital. So we might be at the Walmart parking lot in Philadelphia. We were in a high school parking lot. We were at a church parking lot in another town. We went into my hometown of Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, and we're in a supermarket parking lot. And it was, I have to say, it was incredibly powerful to see. So the patients we're targeting, obviously females, they don't have insurance. And a lot of them never even had a mammography. What's scary, Moira, is some of these women were well over the age of 60 and never had a mammography. And the partner institution that we're dealing with, they bring their staff to help run the equipment. Our staff does the registrations. We have to make sure everything's set up. We need security. We need to have power, right? There's a lot of logistics. You have to work with the state on getting everything approved. So we've gotten really good at the logistical piece. And sometimes we'll be there for a couple of weeks. I think, in certain instances, in a couple of weeks, we've scanned over 300, close to 400 women at Wake Med and at MUSC and University of Pennsylvania, as an example, and at University of Missouri. And unfortunately, sometimes something is found and the hospital agrees to follow those patients and follow up on those patients. Okay. So it's just been wonderful. This is why we do what we do, right? It's very powerful. It feels like for some reason, when we bring the truck to an area that people are more comfortable, it gets a lot of people. In fact, in some cases, Moira, we haven't had enough available slots. We filled up 2 weeks worth of scanning, right? And we've had to stay longer to try to get everybody. You know, we do, social media advertising. We advertise through the local churches and schools so people know about it. Kids tell their parents. The other thing that's been so fascinating about this is at the same time, and I gave you the example, one time we did it at a high school, maybe twice we've done it at a high school now. We've actually had the kids come out and they ask about, what are you doing? And this is how they learned about careers in healthcare, which is, that's like a grand slam.
A twofer. Yeah. It's a twofer. Twofer. Yeah. All right, grand slam. Right? All of it. Yeah.
We're taking care of people that don't have insurance, the underserved community, and we're also finding potential workers of the future. So it's just a win-win, and we're so proud of the team. Our team does a great job. Of course, all of our partners, all these healthcare institutions I mentioned, they do a great job, and it's very powerful. It's emotional, right? It's a big deal.
Well, I just have to say this has really been terrific, Dave. Going forward, is this the big vision, or is there even bigger vision for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think about that a lot because You know, and I'll answer it. I promise I'll answer it. But things change so fast in healthcare. So we got to be flexible. And I'll give you examples why I say that. You know, a couple years ago, if I went to a healthcare institution and I talked to a CEO, they were only talking about one thing. Well, that was COVID, right? How could you help us? You know, we have all this stuff going on with COVID. Then as a result of COVID, we had the workforce topic, right? Because a lot of people left the workforce, right? That was hard being a healthcare worker during COVID, and people decided to retire. And then, you know, today, if you talk to them, they say, you know, sustainability is a topic, right? You know, we're trying to do things in a more carbon neutral fashion. And, you know, healthcare throws out a lot of carbon, right? At a hospital, right? And they're not the most energy efficient places. So now we're working on how do we help them with some of those problems. So if I think about the big vision, I mean, ultimately, we want to really impact healthcare in a meaningful way, right? We really want to do that. We want to help our partners. We want to be very customizable. And we say, look, tell us where your pain points are, and we'll be honest with you and tell you if we can help you or if we can't help you. And we sort of put our money where our mouth is, and we really try to do things that make a big impact. Sometimes the problem is around efficiencies or driving out costs, right? And we work on those things as well.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I think that if any of your employees listen to this, they're going to be in total fear that you're going to make them run wind sprints. It's like, you know, okay, first we're going to run down the field.
Hey, I got a couple of them. I think I'd do that anyway.
That's terrific. I really appreciate you coming in. I hope you come back. See us again.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Dave Pacitti is the president of Siemens Health and Ears. More information is available at Siemens. That's S-I-E-M-E-N-S, Siemens-HealthandEars.com. And now, a quick word. Unless there's a special reason to do it earlier, it's generally recommended that women start getting mammograms starting at around age 40. Initially, this would be done annually, and then as the years go by, every other year, until age 75, when mammograms are no longer deemed necessary. So the age range for mammograms is 40 to 75. This represents about 80 million American women. And yet a quarter of these women, that's one out of four, has never had a mammogram. As with all cancers, early detection means effective life-saving treatment. And early is the key. With hundreds of thousands of breast cancer cases already being diagnosed each year, please have your mammogram and help others to have their mammograms. The reward is either peace of mind or an action plan that will work. Technology is not perfect, but when it can do a good job for us, let's use it. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.